Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Brian Lynn, and Dan Friedel. Later, Alice Bryant will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, nearly one in four Americans made money over the last 12 months by using their personal computers or other devices connected to the Internet. The Pew Research Center, an independent research group in Washington, found that people are using the Internet to find extra work. They go online to sell things such as used books and furniture, or they offer to provide services such as babysitting, house cleaning, or computer repairs. The Pew Center asked people if they make money from the Internet or computing devices, and if so, what they do to earn their pay. The answers provided the findings of Pew's new report on what has been called the gig economy. Pew found that income earned on the Internet can come in many forms. Many Americans said they used their computers to do extra work. About 5% of Americans said they did online computer work over the last year. Some of these people said they had jobs that paid a few pennies each to take surveys. In these surveys, people are asked for their opinions of different products or well-known people. Others typed reports or other information on their home computers. Using digital devices to offer a service online was another way to earn income. About 2% of Americans earned money from ride-sharing companies such as Uber and Lyft. When drivers are ready to pick up passengers, they use their rideshare company's app. The computer program lets them know when passengers are ready to be picked up and how to reach them. Some people make their homes, apartments, or rooms inside their homes available for money to people visiting their cities. A popular website people use to make rooms available is www.airbnb.com. Other people use apps on their computer devices that permit people to hire them to babysit, walk dogs, or do repair or cleanup work. Apps operated from phones or tablets connect them to people looking for such services. About 60% of people involved in the gig economy say the income they earn is important to them. But just 1 in 5 people who sell things online say the income is enough to be important to their lives. Only 16% believe doing online work will lead to a meaningful career. But 37% say the extra income earned from online jobs helps them make up for shortages in money. The number one reason people gave for taking online jobs was that the work gave them something to do and was fun. Pew said that reason was listed by 42% of people it questioned. But opinions about the online economy are mixed. 68% say the gig economy is good for people who want flexibility when they work. Flexibility means they do not have to work when they are at their regular jobs or have family or school events or other things they want or need to do. But 23% say online work lets companies take advantage of employees, and only 16% believe they can build careers with gig work. By taking advantage, some people mean they do not get paid enough for work done through online companies. About 1 in 5 say they take online jobs to gain work experience, while 17% say it is because they cannot find other jobs. What kind of people work online or use online devices to find work? The answer appears to be mostly people who already have jobs. According to Pew, 68% say they are already employed full-time or part-time. 23% say they are students. 32% say they have no other jobs.
The top appeals court in Egypt overturned life sentences against former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and officials of the Muslim Brotherhood. The court canceled the second of two life sentences against the former president. A death sentence against Morsi had been overturned by the same court a week before, in the middle of November. The overturned charges include accusations of spying for the militant group Hamas. Abdelmunim Abdelmaksoud is a lawyer for the Muslim Brotherhood. The group has been outlawed in Egypt. He told the French news agency AFP he believes the court's decision was fair because, in his words, the first verdict was full of legal flaws. The former president and his associates will be retried in the two cases that were overturned. Morsi must still serve a 20-year sentence for his part in the detention and torture of protesters outside the presidential palace in 2012. Morsi became Egypt's first democratically elected president in 2012, but he was arrested after being ousted by the Egyptian military in 2013. Former Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi then took power. Since then, thousands of officials and supporters of Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood have faced trials. The Sisi government's crackdown drew criticism from around the world. Human rights groups have accused Sisi of ordering imprisonment and executions for political reasons. Sisi has denied having influence over Egypt's courts, according to reports in the Wall Street Journal. Many rulings have been overturned in the past 2 years, but many people are still serving sentences or are awaiting trial. Saeed Sadiq is an Egyptian political expert. He told VOA that the easing of sentences against Muslim Brotherhood officials may have been influenced by the U.S. presidential election. Sadiq says the Egyptian government may believe it can deal with the situation. They feel now that they are strong enough to do whatever they want, as long as it doesn't lead to any provocations, he says. However, Sadiq says he does not believe that the series of retrials will lead to acquittals soon. The legitimacy of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's regime depends on fighting terrorism, so acquitting Muslim Brotherhood leaders would be counterproductive to this strategy for the time being, he said. I'm John Russell.
Most of us still have lots of photographs sitting around from the days when we used cameras, not telephones, to take pictures. There are probably many photos stored away that we do not look at and may never see again. But these images, representing memories from our past, do not have to be lost. Google has created a tool to help bring these forgotten pictures back to life in very high quality. The recently launched PhotoScan app works the same as an image scanner. But this software program uses the camera on your phone to capture images as digital copies. It is a quick and easy way to save old photos without having to spend money on new equipment. The PhotoScan app uses new technology to improve the capturing process. This makes it possible to take a picture of a photo with a camera phone without glare, a common problem. After opening the app, the user first positions the desired photo within the camera's frame. When this is done, four small circles appear in different places over the photo. The user then moves the phone over each of the circles, which change color after the process is complete. And that's it. The app finds the edges of the photo, straightens the image, and puts it in the right position while removing glare. From this point, the pictures can easily be saved to the Google Photos app, or somewhere else. If you do have Google Photos, images are organized by face or place and can easily be searched. The release of PhotoScan came at the same time as some changes to the Google Photos app. One change is an improved auto-enhance tool that Google says creates high-quality effects in just one step. Another tool lets users choose from 12 different looks to improve overall photo quality. The third provides high-level controls for changing light and colors. Anil Sabarwal is the vice president of Google Photos. He told CNET the idea for photo scan came from his own family's experiences. He explained that in 1947, his parents lived under British colonial rule in India. They were Hindu and forced to move when their community became part of the Muslim state of Pakistan. His parents were ordered to quickly leave their home with only a few belongings they could carry. He said they decided to leave behind jewelry and other valuables, but gathered up as many photos as they could take. PhotoScan is available now for both Android and iOS. I'm Brian Lynn.
A European Union program is letting blind people experience famous paintings for the first time. The program is called Access to Museums for Blind and Visually Impaired People. It uses three-dimensional printing to recreate famous paintings so they can be touched. One painting printed with the new technology is Gustav Klimt's The Kiss. It is a popular attraction at the Belvedere Museum in Vienna, Austria. The painting shows a man and a woman standing in a field filled with flowers. They are wearing gold robes and have their arms around each other. The man leans down to kiss the woman. Klimt finished the painting in 1908. Until now, people who had trouble seeing could not appreciate the artwork. But thanks to the reproduction, they can. While the original artwork is flat, this one is in three dimensions. It is white and much smaller than the original. Museum visitors can touch the piece and feel the ridges and depressions. Andreas Reichinger started making 3D versions of artwork in 2010. He said The Kiss was his most difficult project because the couple's robes are so detailed. Dominika Radic is a blind museum visitor. She touched the reproduction. As she moved her hands around it, she said, "Exactly. Can you see these? There are so many details." Radic said she can imagine what the original painting looks like when she touches the reproduction. "It's somehow round. It's entangled. It's round. You can feel it. You can feel it. It comes with it, and in many places it's so smooth. And then I think to myself, it probably shines, too." The Belvedere is not the only museum to have 3D versions of its artwork. Some of the pieces at the Prado in Madrid, Spain, have reproductions that can be touched. But the piece in Vienna has one special part. It is made with widely available 3D printing technology. That means one day, blind art fans anywhere in the world could download the source files and print the reproductions themselves. I'm Dan Friedel.
Every year, around the Thanksgiving holiday, a strange ceremony happens in Washington, D.C. The president stands outside the White House, gives a brief speech, and then officially pardons a turkey. A pardon is a declaration that someone will not be punished. In this ceremony, President Barack Obama promises not to cook and eat a certain turkey, even though turkeys are the traditional Thanksgiving meal. You might be asking yourself, what is the connection between turkeys, Thanksgiving, and grammar? In today's report, we explore what turkeys can teach you about English verbs. In particular, we will show you how Thanksgiving can teach you to use stative verbs. We will also show you the difference between stative and progressive verbs.
The term stative verb refers to a verb that has a stative meaning. In other words, these verbs show or describe conditions or situations that do not do anything but exist. Verbs that commonly have a stative meaning include verbs that show emotional states, such as love and dislike, verbs that describe sense perceptions, such as smell or taste, verbs that show existence, such as seem or look. In the present tense, a verb with a stative meaning is generally used in its simple form. I love turkey, or Americans like turkey, are two examples. Verbs that have stative meanings are generally not used in the progressive tense. So, you will probably not hear a native speaker say, I am loving turkey, or Americans are liking turkey.
Do not fear. We can use our Thanksgiving example to make the point clearer. Imagine you are at an American store. You hear a conversation between a customer and a store employee. The customer wants to buy a turkey that weighs 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms. Unlike the turkey from the pardoning ceremony, this turkey will have a sad fate, the dinner table. The conversation you hear might go like this.
How much does that turkey weigh?
It weighs 10 pounds.
How much does it cost?
It costs $20.
In the dialogue, you can hear two examples of stative verbs, weigh and cost. The butcher said, the turkey weighs 10 pounds, and the turkey costs $20. In both cases, the verbs have a stative meaning. The butcher is describing a condition or situation that simply exists, the weight and cost of the turkey. Now imagine you are eating Thanksgiving dinner with an American family.
you might hear any one of the following sentences.
I love turkey.
I dislike turkey.
The turkey smells wonderful.
The food tastes great.
The turkey seems undercooked.
The turkey looks awful.
All these sentences include stative verbs. You might notice that the verbs are also in the simple present form.
So, why would an English speaker not say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," or "I am disliking turkey"? Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber are two English grammar experts. They say that, in general, English speakers use the progressive tense only when the subject of the verb actively controls the state or action. In addition, English speakers generally use the progressive only when the verb describes an action or state that happens over an extended period of time. So, you would not hear an English speaker say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," because the subject of the verb, the turkey, does not control its state, being undercooked. For the same reason, you would not hear an English speaker say, "I am disliking turkey," because the verb's subject, I, probably does not have control over the action of disliking turkey. Now, some verbs can have stative and progressive meanings. Consider these examples.
The food tastes good.
President Obama is tasting the food.
In the first sentence, the food does not control whether it is good or bad. As a result, the verb taste has a stative meaning because it simply describes the condition of the food. In the second sentence, President Obama is tasting the food, the subject of the verb, President Obama, has control over his action. In addition, the action takes place over an extended period of time. Obama must think about tasting food, then raise the food to his mouth, then consider its quality. So, you could say that the verb taste in this example has a progressive meaning.
The next time you are reading or listening to the news, pay special attention to the verbs. Notice when the progressive form is used and when the simple form is used. Then ask yourself why. Does the verb's subject control the action? Does the action occur over an extended period of time? Or does the verb simply describe a condition that exists? If you are still confused about whether you should use a simple or progressive verb in your own conversations, Conrad and Biber have one tip that might help you. They say that in conversations, English speakers use simple verbs around 120 times in every 1,000 words. Progressive verbs are much less common. They appear fewer than 20 times in every 1,000 words. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.